Hi, this is Amy.
And this is Andrew, and in this episode, AADL talks to Delia Efron.
Recently, Jackie had the opportunity to sit and talk with author, playwright, and screenwriter Delia Efron about her life and work, what it was like growing up in a household of writers and collaborating with her sister Nora, and the importance of storytelling in young adult fiction. Efron also talks about how chocolate pudding inspired her first book and what a woman's wardrobe says about her life.
Welcome, Delia, and thank you for speaking with us. Now, you live in New York now, but you grew up in Beverly Hills. What was it like growing up in the Efron household?
My parents were screenwriters. My mother was a writer before women really had jobs or did anything. We were the only family, at least that we knew. In our community, my mother was the only working mother. And it was a huge thing that she was a working mother. She wore it with great pride, and she wanted all her daughters to have careers. So when everyone else was telling their daughters to, you know, get married and have children, my mother was telling us, leave home, go to New York, have a career. And by career, she meant be a writer. In the family, it was like the family business. It was unspoken as well as spoken, because at dinner table conversations, we would play word games. We'd play 20 questions, or we'd do charades or something. It was all sort of to prime us to be quick on our feet and to have opinions. There was a lot of conversation about whatever was going on, and we were expected to be bright. And if we said something funny, my father would yell, "That's a great line, write it down."
Now, they went to Hollywood to be screenwriters. Where were they from?
They were New Yorkers, which is why they wanted us to go back where it was serious. And there were no palm trees back there. They got married, and they had a hit play in like 1943 called Three's a Family. And I have a picture of them with Eleanor Roosevelt backstage, which I have right above my desk, because she went to see the play and came backstage to meet them. And then they were offered a contract, as many people were then, to go out to Hollywood and be screenwriters. And then you worked right up the studio. They made so many more movies than they make now. They just churned them out, and you would just get one job after another. It was a fantastic life.
Did you meet many movie stars growing up?
Yes, I did, but my mother had rules, and one of the rules was you cannot ask anyone for an autograph. They are no better than you, and you had to understand that, so there was no worship allowed. But I did meet, Fred Astaire, and I met Marilyn Monroe. I remember it. I met others, but I really remember her. I don't even know why she had her hair in a bandana, and it was on the set of No Business Like Show Business, which my parents were the screenwriters of, and she patted me on the head and said, "Hi, Delia."
How did you end up in New York?
Well, of course, I was forced to by my mother. I mean, I had no choice in our family. It would have been heresy to end up anywhere else. But I actually took a roundabout route. First, I went to Connecticut College, and then I was unhappy there, and I went to Barnard. And the minute I stepped foot in New York, I knew I had found home.
What do you like best about living in New York?
Yesterday, in New York, there was a dance parade. Okay, I decided to go out to lunch. I walked to the corner, and there is every nationality dancing down the street to the most fantastic music. African, Mexican, salsa, anything you could. I mean, the New York world was, I mean, what other city has a dance parade? And you just leave your house to have lunch, and it's so unimportant that you wouldn't even know about it. It happens all the time. New York's a walking city. And if you love to walk and you don't want to be in a car, which I do, I don't want to be in a car. I like to leave the house. I like to interact with all sorts of people. Everyone's in it together. We all travel the subways. It's full of rich people, but it's all, I mean, Manhattan is an expensive place to live, but it's also full of the whole world, and I love it.
Do you miss anything about California?
Well, my stepson, he lives there. I miss him. I miss my sister Amy and my nieces and who also live there, and all my great girlfriends and some male friends. But do I actually miss Los Angeles? No, it is one gigantic traffic jam. It's actually a traffic jam between earthquakes.
Now, you came from a family of writers, and you have three sisters, and you're all writers. How much of that was an influence from your parents, and how much of it was something you truly were destined to do?
It must have been an incredible combination of genetics and environment, because, as I said, the environment was such that we just had to be writers, and obviously the genetic content, I mean, both our parents were writers, so we must have all gotten it. We're certainly all successful enough, but my sister Nora became a writer first, and she sort of knew it from the beginning. And my parents are writers, my older sister's a successful writer. I was 28 before I started writing. And then my sister Amy became a writer in her late 30s, and my sister Hallie became a writer in her late 40s. And we're all published many times, but it must have been a huge mountain. The mountain got taller, you know what I mean? It got bigger and bigger, and it got scarier to start the climb.
Now, your first published work was called How to Eat Like a Child and Other Lessons in Not Being a Grown-Up. How did you come up with that topic?
Okay, well, I just want to say something, that my first published work under the name of my married name from my first marriage was The Adventurous Crocheter. And it was a book about crocheting. But my first book, when I decided to seriously be a writer and establish my identity, was definitely How to Eat Like a Child. And it was because I was eating chocolate pudding. I was sitting in my house, and I was eating it the way that I always had. It was cooked pudding then, and we always cooked chocolate pudding, and it had a little skin at the top, and I was digging a little hole in the top of the skin and sort of scooping the pudding out, and I thought, oh my gosh, I was like, obviously I was about 29 years old, and I thought, I'm eating like a child. So I wrote this very funny piece about a deadpan instructions about how children eat, like, you know, with the Malamar, peel the chocolate off, you know, then eat the graham cracker bottom and then leave the marshmallow between the cushions of the couch. It was like that kind of a thing. And it was in the New York Times. They bought it, and it was a sensational experience. There was no going viral then, but that was essentially what happened. And I was offered a book contract based on that.
And it was made into a movie.
It became a book, which was a bestseller, called How to Eat Like a Child and Other Lessons in Not Being a Grown-Up. And then it became a television movie. And now it's also a stage play with music for children. And it's performed all over the country and all over Canada every year.
Do you make it to any of the performances?
I have an occasion. On occasion, I get an invitation. Oh, we're doing it in Pacific Palisades. Will you come see it? But, you know, literally, 500 theaters a year do it.
Now, you have written several novels for adults as well as for teens and children. How different is it writing for each of the different markets? And which one is most fun?
Fun. Well, screenwriting is the most fun. If you're talking about fun, you know, just like sitting there, because it's easy. It isn't easy to write a good screenplay, but it's easier to kind of, there are no literary problems. It's all dialogue and images and storytelling. It's very pared down, and the final product isn't published anywhere, so you don't really even need to worry about your words that much. So I guess that's the easiest thing. But I loved reading as a child so much. I mean, my fondest memories are coming home and curling up with the Betsy Tacy books or the Anne of Green Gables or The Secret Garden. And I think storytelling, the way stories are told in those books, where you just can't get out of the chair because you're just so in love with the book, I fell in love with that kind of storytelling then. And I do think that one of the things about YA books is that they're very story-driven. And that's one reason why they get options for movies so much. They can be more story-driven than even well-written or something. So they're a little bit, I think, probably, they're a little easier, actually, for me to write than an adult novel, which I feel has to be fleshed out I don't know. Franny and Peace is my YAs. I'm really very attached to that book. But I think that adult novels, for me, are the greatest. In the end, the greatest fun and the greatest challenge and the most satisfying, just But you're asking me to choose among my children.
What comes first, your intended audience or the storyline? I mean, do you come with a storyline and say, okay, this one will be for YA market or?
Oh, actually, when I started writing books and then I got into screenwriting, I promised myself that I would always continue to write books because I felt that books expressed my identity, where I am in life, the stories I personally want to tell, whereas screenplays become movies and they are collaborations of all sorts of people's opinions and ideas and visions. And so I've had ideas, and each time I have an idea, I almost know what it is. Like even a play that Nora and I did that is based on a book called Love, Loss, and What I Wore by Eileen Beckerman. The minute we saw this, we knew it was a play. It wasn't a movie. It didn't have a through line. It was already a book. So it didn't need to be our book. But every time I have an idea, the idea tells me what it is.
Your play, Love, Loss, and What I Wore, you co-wrote with your sister, and it's based on a book. And the Off-Broadway production won several very important awards. It was about women's relationship and the wardrobe. Now, the sisterhood of the traveling pant is about a pair of very special blue jeans. And in your latest novel, The Lion is In, you describe in great detail this wedding dress this girl ran away in. So obviously, fashion is very central to you.
Well, not fashion, but
wardrobe.
Wardrobe. Yeah, what we wear. I think if you ask women about their clothes, they tell you about their lives. And that is really what that play was based on. And I guess it's not the label at all. It's what so many things. If you ask a woman what she was wearing, she'll tell you the story of her divorce, her marriage, falling in love, her prom dress, which always is a story about the prom and the guy and what that was about. And the falsies that ended up floating in the swimming pool. You always end up finding out about women's lives when you ask about their clothes. So with my characters, I mean, I knew, for instance, that yes, Tracy was in a wedding dress, which told me an enormous amount about where she was coming from and what her life was about. And I knew that Rita was wearing was the third character in the story, heroine. She was wearing what she wore to church that morning. And so, you know, that told me a lot. I don't think it's true for men, by the way. I mean, not that we couldn't look at men, it's music or cars, you know, but for women, it's clothes, and it starts with your mother. You go shopping with your mother. When you rebel with clothes. You know, you wear things that shock her, that upset her. She calls you a slut. You look like a tramp, whatever. You know what I mean? We define our lives with our clothes. When we need to have a new identity, we frequently, the first place we go is the department store. When by accident we buy something we don't want, it's because we put an identity on that had nothing to do with us. And we got home and we thought, what was I thinking in that store? There's so much drama to shopping for women. And it's rich.
Are you a shopper?
Not anymore. Now I just wear black. But clothes are for younger women. You know, clothes are for women. I mean, when I was in my 20s, I could shop with the best of them. But now I just feel, you know, that I just wear, you know, with a uniform that I feel really good in. And I'm a New York woman, so black is my color.
Have Bill Cunningham taken your picture?
Oh, I wish.
Don't you watch that column every week?
I think he is a genius.
Isn't he?
Yeah, I do. I was just looking at it today. I couldn't believe what women were wearing. He spots trends that nobody even knows about.
Yes, he's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, this is a desert island question. What three items from your personal wardrobe or your personal effect would you want if you were stranded? Like, you can take your BlackBerry if that's one.
Oh, yeah, no. I don't think I would do that. Well, first of all, I couldn't get reception. I have a little practical streak because I'd probably want, you know, a book that taught me how to spear fish or something. But I would certainly take a volume of W.H. Auden with me because I think his poetry is beyond fantastic and you couldn't read it over and over again. And it's got everything. It's got love and pain and history and all sorts of things that are really rich. So I would certainly take that. And I would probably take my husband.
Oh. Would he want to go?
Although he would not want to be there, and he would get a million bug bites within 15 seconds of being there. Yeah, I would probably take bug spray.
Let's talk about animals. I see that you're wearing a lion on around your neck today. So there is always a pet or an animal central to the plot in almost every one of your novels. Why is it? Like the dachshund in Big City Eye, and of course the lion in this one. Tell us about your relationship with animals.
That is so interesting. I hadn't realized that, but of course, yes, that is true. I got a dog when I became a stepmother. And any stepmother who listens to this podcast should get a dog if they don't have one, because it's really nice to have someone in the house that loves you. So I think... And one of my biggest regrets, I have to say, and I probably would take to a desert island, I would probably take my dog, is that I didn't really have, I wish I had dogs my whole life. And when I got a dog, I realized how animals sort of expand your mind and your heart. And there is nothing like coming home to that sound they make, which those yelps that sound like happy weeping. And... the sweetness, the calmness they produce in a room, the how many times they make you laugh in a day. I mean, there is just something remarkable about a dog. I've never really had a cat, In this story of mine, the lion is in. There is a lion, and there was a lion because the story came from a dream. The lion was in the dream. And I was trying to figure out afterwards why a lion, I mean, I understood the story and the function he had in the story, but why had I dreamed a lion, aside from its unbelievably fantastic use in this story? And I think that, well, the lion is, of course, the fiercest of the big animals, at least by reputation. He's a character in one of my favorite books, which is Higgledy Piggledy Pop by Maurice Sendak. A dog leaves home and has to sort of grapple with a lion before she can go off and be famous. But I think that there are all these points in our lives where you have to dig down and have the imagination to change our lives. And sometimes to do that, we have to get in the cage with a lion. And that, I think, was what I was doing when I wrote this book.
Okay, the public is probably more familiar with your work with feature films, and I hear that you really like writing screenplays. You wrote a number of screenplays, including the adaptation of your novels Hanging Up, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, and such perennial favorite as Bewitched, You've Got Mail, which you also produced, and you also produced Sleepless in Seattle. How did you get into the business of screenwriting?
Because of Nora. Not because of Nora. First, because of my husband. I had written a couple of very funny books. I wrote How to Eat Like a Child, and then I wrote a book called Teenage Romance. And I was, at that point, they were making a lot of television movies then, which they aren't anymore at all the networks like NBC and CBS and ABC. And they asked me if I wanted to write a movie based on Teenage Romance. So I didn't know how, but my husband said, well, I'll teach you how, because he's a screenwriter. So I would go off to my office and just make a mess of things all day. And then I would come home and I would show the work to him. And he would say, where's the drama? Where's the conflict? You're not moving story. You know, who are your characters? And he just really, he's a great teacher. He taught after he retired for many years at Columbia at the film school, University at the Film School, and he taught at the AFI. So, I mean, I just fell into the best hands. And I wrote a couple of screenplays that didn't get made. And then, to my good fortune, Nora, who had already written the amazing When Harry Met Sally, she wanted to be a director, and she didn't want to be alone on the set. She wanted someone she completely trusted. And we've always been really close in growing up our whole lives. I mean, all the sisters get along, but Nora and I, I'm the second. She's the oldest. I'm the second oldest. And so she said, did I, and we share a sensibility, and she said, would I co-write this screenplay with her? And so from then on, we started collaborating.
And how different is it writing for the stage, like you play, and writing for the screen?
I really, writing for the screen is trying to make everybody happy. First of all, the most important thing about writing for the screen is, unless your sister is the director, you're probably going to get fired off the project. I mean, screenwriters get fired. Book writers don't get fired. Playwrights don't get fired. This is huge difference. So you better be making some decent money for what, because as all screenwriters do, nothing but complain. I've always thought that screenwriters have a choice. They can either become directors or become miserable. And for me, I had the third choice. I could become a novelist. And that, so to have my own voice and no one get in my way for the stories I want to tell. So, I mean, the great thing about a playwright is that you are just unbelievably respected in the theater. If you sit there, whatever you think, no one will be cast. You know, you are in rehearsals all the time. Your thoughts are as unbelievably important, and it's an intimate experience. You're just in there. And the thing about theater, which I don't know if everyone realizes, I certainly didn't until I was involved in it, a performance is different every single night. The combination of the actors' chemistry and what they're feeling that night and the connection they make with the audience and what kind of an audience comes in, you have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. It's terribly fun and exciting and scary, but it's very alive. A movie, as I said, you're the lowest man on the totem pole if you're the writer. So you do basically what other people want, what the director wants, and part of what they value about you is how flexible you are, your ability to hear and adapt. And it's a whole nother way of being. It's never, you have to always remember what you want, but you always have to temper it with what they want. And you're constantly, the rules are shifting. Is it okay with you because you want to make people happy? It can change all the time. An actor comes on, his part changes, the story changes. The actress comes on, it changes for her, changes for the director. The studio gives you notes. What can I say?
So you actually are on the set during the filming, and then you keep making changes?
No, that's really interesting. I'm only on the set if Nora's making the movie or if I have a wonderful relationship with the director. I was not on the set for The Sister to the Traveling Pants. I was invited to visit. But usually the writer is just left behind. But the great thing about working with Nora was that I was always on the set, so I learned so much about movie making. And I was in the editing room, and I would be at publicity meetings. I was really was unusually blessed in that situation.
How fun was it filming?
When it goes
Meg
well,
Ryan.
When it goes well, it's nothing more fun.
Do you get a good rapport with the actor and the actresses?
Well, it depends on the actor, doesn't it? And you know what I mean. But for the most part, yes. I don't think I've – well, we've had some difficult ones, you know.
And we don't want you to tell
us. No, I can't. But, you know, yeah, there are people you want to stay out of the way of, yeah. No question.
What is it like to collaborate with Nora? Do you work out of the same dining room table? Do you do it by email?
Well, we certainly – get together and we sit in a room together with one, you know, with a computer, and we'll talk character and story and outline, and then we might split the work up or we might write a scene and the other one, and then you think I can't get any further with this, why don't you take it from here? It's changed a lot over time because we know each other so well now. We might work a little bit more alone. But the important thing is that we always have to have a project that we are both passionate about but not too passionate about, in the sense that, I mean, I could not do a screenplay with her, for instance, based on this novel, just because this novel is just too much 100% me. And when she did Julia, I mean, Nora's an obsessive cook and obsessed with Julia, and that had to be hers, you know? So you find, with us it's easy, but we find the common ground. You've Got Mail is We both loved the movie it was based on. We both loved the idea, and we decided to place it in a bookstore because we grew up loving books so much. So we found a place of passion for the story.
Now, you said in your bio that you became a writer after many detours. You want to share that?
Well, sure. I became a writer. Well, I should have just become a writer because that was what I was supposed to do. But, of course, I was terrified. So, and besides, aren't your 20s the biggest mess? I mean, you get out of college. And I was just terrified to do anything. So I just got married as a way of avoiding it to the first man who asked me. And it was not a good match. And we went up to Rhode Island to live there because he was teaching at Brown. And I really wanted to be in New York. I was not happy up there at all in an academic community. Was hard for me. It's very insular. And but I was, you know, I was sort of trying to be, I don't know what I was trying to be. I didn't know what I was. Anyway, so I got a job as an assistant in a design studio of some sort. I can't think of what in the world they were designing now, years later. But the boss was just unbelievably mean. And he was sort of nice to me. So I thought, oh, okay, he's not going to be mean to me. But, of course, mean bosses are eventually mean to everyone, right? So eventually he just turns his irritation and wrath on me. And after a few days, I said, I quit. And as I walked out the door, he shouted, you're flat-chested. I swear, isn't that hysterical? So now I'm like unemployed and flat-chested, and what am I going to do? So I decided to start crocheting. And I, right? That makes a lot of sense, right? I went into the crocheting business, and that was another detour. And then I was doing nothing but crochet purses and belts day in and day out. I was selling them to New York department stores, and it was really the nutsest thing I've ever done. But I went into New York one week, and I went to a cocktail party, and there was an editor from Simon & Schuster there. And I said that I really wanted to write a book on crocheting. No, I said, I know you'd never be interested in this, but would you want to do a book about crocheting? And for some reason, he said yes. I have no idea why. It couldn't have been my beautiful presentation, and it was a guy, so what did he know about crocheting? I really don't know. But he said yes, and he bought the book, and I was a writer.
Okay, this is an if question. What would you most likely be doing if you did not become a writer?
I think I would be an artist.
What kind? Painter? Musician?
I haven't gotten, I don't know, but the other week I took a trip, and I decided with a group of people, and we were all, none of us can draw, so I gave us all notebooks to draw in, figuring it would just level the playing field, and there were some kids too, and they would probably be able to draw better. And I started drawing, and I actually realized I could sort of draw. And then I showed it to one of my sisters, and she said, oh my God, if we hadn't had that mother, you would have been, I mean, it was so obvious that I could draw. It's weird. And I don't mean it was great, but I just had a feeling for it. And I thought, God, if I hadn't had the most controlling mother in the world, God knows what I might have been. But nothing to do with math. I will tell you that I am a mathematical disaster.
I'm with you there.
Yeah. A mathematical disaster.
To learn more about Delia Ephron, visit DeliaEphronWriter.com. Music for this episode was Reaching and Bracing by Nathan Mathis, which you can find on the AADL catalog by going to aadl.org/magnatune.
AADL Talks to Delia Ephron is a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.